and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
I've been opposed to any taxes that are broad-based or that would affect working families.
Lawmakers still hammering out ways to fill the state's budget gap as the legislative deadline approaches. Journalist Jonathan Capehart gets personal in a new memoir, Yet Here I Am, Lessons from a Black Man's Search for Home. Will I and a new opera on lesser-known Black sheroes. But first, lawmakers just dropped a long-awaited plan to reform oversight of Chicago-area public transit. Meanwhile, they're still figuring out how to address potential Medicaid cuts and federal funding uncertainties as the legislative deadline approaches. Our Nick Blumberg joins us now live from Springfield. Nick, what is in this new transit bill?
Well, Brandis, this measure would replace the Regional Transportation Authority with the new Northern Illinois Transit Authority. It would be empowered to coordinate things like fare policy and major capital projects. Now, CTA, Metra, and PACE, they'd essentially be operational divisions focused on running buses and trains. Now, lawmakers have been clear there won't be revenue to fill transit's massive budget gap next year without reforms, but that revenue is not in this bill. Now, given the complexity of the change, the measure creates a runway with a working group set to be seated by April of next year. Other provisions include things like a transit ambassador program, and that working group would also be charged with coming up with a report on potentially creating a transit police force.
And Nick, advocates are also pushing back against potential cuts to Medicaid and health care for undocumented people. What's at stake there?
That's right. This comes in the context of President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill that cleared the U.S. House and is now in the Senate. The current version includes some $700 billion in cuts to Medicaid. It would also cut matching dollars for states that offer health coverage to immigrants, both legally present and undocumented. Now, Governor Pritzker's budget proposal earlier this year moved to trim that health coverage for undocumented immigrants between ages 42 and 64. That's something that immigrant advocates want to see restored. Let's take a listen.
When we strip health care from undocumented, we also strain our hospitals. We increase uncompensated care, and we risk the well-being of everyone, not just one population.
Now, one immigrant advocate told me that those cuts are essentially pre-complying with something that may not actually come to fruition. She also said some lawmakers are still pushing to restore coverage for those adult immigrants in the state budget, but it's unclear whether that's going anywhere.
And Nick, we know Governor Pritzker spoke with the media earlier today. What did he say about where the budget stands right now?
Well, as you might expect, Pritzker told us he is in conversation with legislative leaders every day during this very busy month of May. Now, given how challenging a budget year it is, the governor was asked whether he would support an idea that's been floated for years, a sales tax on services. But Pritzker said any broad-based taxes that would negatively affect working families, he's opposed to. Here's some of what he said.
I've been pretty clear with everybody that, you know, individual income taxes, corporate income taxes, sales taxes, we are not about raising those taxes at all. I would veto a bill that does that.
He also talked about those potential Medicaid cuts we just mentioned and said he's hopeful there's enough opposition in the U.S. Senate that those won't come to fruition. We also asked him about some measures he's backed this session, for example, banning cell phones from classrooms and allowing community colleges to offer certain four-year degrees. Now, those have run into opposition from some members of the Black Caucus, but Pritzker said he's still hopeful they will be called for a vote. And he told us while he hasn't been pushing for any specific revenue options to address transit's budget gap, he said reforms to better coordinate service are critical. Now, by the way, Pritzker spoke to us after a dedication event at the State Library Reading Room, naming it after former Governor Jim Edgar. Pritzker and many others heaped praise on Edgar as a statesman, with Pritzker joking, you got to be careful which former governors of Illinois you try to emulate. And Pritzker added that Edgar's number one piece of advice that he gave Pritzker when he took office, pass a budget. Certainly something that is top of mind for folks down here this week. Brandis.
A couple more days, Nick, in Springfield for us. Thank you. Up next, journalist Jonathan Capehart on his new memoir.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
A Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, editor, columnist, PBS NewsHour political analyst, and MSNBC host lays it all bare in his new book. Jonathan Capehart shares his life story in the memoir, Yet Here I Am, Lessons from a Black Man's Search for Home. The recounted stories of his upbringing and career illustrate the challenges with embracing his identity and finding his voice. He's found them both, and he shares them with us now. Jonathan Capehart is in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. Welcome to Chicago Tonight, Black Voices.
Thank you very much, Brandis.
So what inspired you to write this book? Why did you want to do that now?
So there were two books that I read 20 years apart that had the same thing that drew me to them and why I love them. One is Personal History by Katharine Graham. You know, the
former publisher of the Washington Post.
Former publisher of the Washington Post, but one of the most powerful women in the country. It's certainly the most powerful woman in journalism at the time. In her autobiography, you talk about laying it all out. I mean, she was raw, open, honest, introspective about her own insecurities, about her fraught relationship with her mother. And I thought when I finished it, wow, this is the kind of book I want to read. You know, none of this puppy dogs and dandelions. Like, she's keeping it real. Fast forward 20 or so years, and Charles Blow's memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, comes out, and I read that, and it's the same thing. Raw, open, honest, introspective. And it made me understand the passion that fueled his columns for the New York Times. And so I thought, if ever I had the opportunity to write a memoir, that I would do the same thing. I would be open and honest and raw as I could be about certainly my successes, but most definitely about my shortcomings and my failures, because that's where the lessons come in. That's where people connect and see maybe a part of themselves, even if they're not Black or even if they're not LGBTQ, certainly in the way that I felt a connection to Kay Graham, and I'm nothing like her.
So an answer that comes with both two book recommendations, which I appreciate, but also, and I've read the book, you are honest, and you also share some lessons, which hopefully we'll get to. Mm-hmm. But you also talk about the time you spent growing up as a kid, of course, and spending some of that time with your grandparents in Severn in North Carolina. And you talk about the significance of your generation in particular. Mm-hmm. How does that make you sort of an unlikely story, as your title suggests, Yet Here I Am?
So, you know, in Severn, North Carolina, it's a town so small that you have to, when you hit Google Maps and you hit that plus sign, you gotta zoom all the way in so that you can see the tiny grid of the streets. You know, as I write in the book, my cousin Rita and I are the first generation in our family to not have to pick cotton. And for people of a certain age, they will understand what that means. But for the youngins out there, I was born 3 years to the day after the 1964 Civil Rights Act was enacted. 2 years before, 2 years after the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Why is that significant? Because with those two laws, the Constitution was now available. All of the words of the Constitution applied to everyone, to African Americans. And so freedom of opportunity and access to education and everything were now unbounded for my generation. And so when Rita and I were running around in the yard in the sprinkler during those summers, you know, it wasn't until I was writing this book that I understood, well, wait. When our parents were our age, they were working. They were working in the fields, picking cotton, picking tobacco. We did not have to do that.
They weren't playing the way you
were. Right, they weren't.
You talk a lot about Blackness and Black identity as well in some very relatable ways. Over the years, Black classmates and colleagues calling you sellout, an Oreo, Uncle Tom, some other words I won't say right here. Mm-hmm. How did you handle that, and why do you think we do that in the Black community?
You know, I'm still trying to figure that out. Look, I always viewed myself, again, as someone who is from that first generation to live, you know, within de jure freedom in America, as an ambassador to other people, to the race. And so in a time when you know, a lot of people didn't know black people. A lot of white people did not know black people. And as, you know, for those African Americans who are either the only one or one of the few in predominantly white spaces, we know what that means. The pressure that comes with that, whether we want it or not. And I just decided to embrace it. I mean, I'm an only child, so I ran out there trying to make friends. But in trying to make friends, particularly in college, you know, that rankled a lot of people, a lot of my black classmates. They didn't understand, like, why don't you hang out with us? And I was like, because I like my roommate, I like my friends. And for a lot of my black classmates, being in that predominantly white space was something that was new to them. And I understand, I now really understand why they gravitated towards each other. But for me, I had the reverse experience. To me, you know, going to Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, that was reverting back to the mean. I was used to going, being the only one and going to predominantly white institutions. And so I think I hesitate to call it a misunderstanding, but it's just sort of misalignment of ideals. I remember an older black classmate took me to task basically for fitting in too well, when you think about it. And so I just had to chuckle at it. But, you know, it's tough. And it's not something that goes away as you get older. It's not something that goes away as you climb the socioeconomic ladder.
And I would imagine for a lot of black people that as they climb that ladder, they are the only black person in the room.
Oh, absolutely.
More and more.
More and more, and for long periods of time. But as I write in the book, you know, blackness, and we talk about blackness, we understand, and I'm sure the audience understands, that, you know, blackness is in the eye of the beholder. So at any given point in my day, I could be too black, I could be not black enough, I could be not black at all. And it has nothing to do with anything.
Or colorless, right. As some people
right.
I mean, would rather see.
Right, nothing that I've done, but it's all because of the other person's perception. And so our level of blackness is in the hands of other people. And again, no matter where you are on the socioeconomic level ladder, you are going to have to deal with it. And maybe in reading this book, people will see, like, you know what? That's what that is. Or I've had that experience. That's what's that about. That is what that is about.
So I want to jump ahead
sure.
to your time at the Washington Post, because, of course, the stories that you have shared there have maybe caused a little bit of controversy for some folks who are close to the Post. The Post, of mm-hmm. course, where you are still a columnist.
Yeah.
You write about your experience on the editorial board, and for about, what, 15 years, being the only black person on
for
that
most
board
of the
time. For most of your time there. You also write about when the time came for you to leave that board and sort of the straw that broke the camel's back for you, an editorial that the board wrote around the Georgia election with a statement that you 100% disagreed with, and how you told your fellow editorial board members as much. You did not talk about it at the time. Why did you not want to talk about your reason for leaving the board publicly at the time?
Look, it was a very searing moment. I did everything that I did that you now read about privately, because that was the way I wanted to handle it. And I don't think it would have been wise or proper at the time to just go out there and spout off. That's just not me. I mean, this is now 2 years, 3 years after the fact. With that time, I had perspective and could look back on what happened. And in the end, and I do urge people to read the chapter, fine, but do not read the chapter in isolation of everything else. It is 11 pages in more than 270 pages. And there are, what, 10 or 11 chapters before that. The reader will not truly understand the context of that chapter if they hadn't read the earlier chapters. And so, you know, I understand people being upset that I put down on paper, you know, why I left the board. And I knew that this would, you know, folks wouldn't be happy. Folks would even start talking about it and saying things, and that's fine. You know, when you speak out and speak your truth, it comes sometimes with consequences. It comes with accountability, and I'm fine with that. I'll stand by everything I wrote in the book gladly, because the book is not about that chapter. The book is about my life.
So much more than just that chapter, of course. We've got about 30 seconds left. So you wrote a book. What's next? What else? Well, you know what? Instead of what's next, let's go with your professional advice. Two things that I picked up. When someone asks you what you want, tell them. Yep. And everything you're doing today is an audition for later in life.
Those are the two big lessons, because I think folks self-sabotage. They think that, I have dreams, therefore I'm never going to say them because someone's going to squash them or they'll never happen. But I encourage people, whenever anybody asks you what you want, tell them, because you never know if the answer is going to be yes. And that's happened to me twice. And then everything we do in life is an audition for something else. We just don't know what yet. And that has proven itself out.
You have to live your life to find out.
Yes.
You have to read the book to find out as well. Jonathan Capehart, thank you so much. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much.
Up next, She Who Dares, a look at civil rights from the Chicago Opera Theater. Stay with us. Some lesser-known black female heroes are taking center stage in a new opera called She Who Dared. It spotlights the women who challenged segregation in Montgomery, telling the story with the use of classical music and gospel, jazz, and the blues. Audiences can see the show starting next week at the Chicago Opera Theater. And joining us now with more on what to expect are composer of She Who Dared, Jasmine Ariel Barnes, Deborah Deep Mouton, the opera's librettist, and Jasmine Habersham, who plays the role of Claudette Colvin. Thanks to all of you for joining us. So we all know the story, of course, of Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her bus seat to a white man. But there are many other women who did similar work, sometimes some of them even before Parks. Deborah Deep Mouton, I want to start with you, please. Who are some of these women?
Absolutely. So we center on seven women, kind of starting with Claudette Colvin being the one who 9 months before Rosa took the seat. Then Aurelia Browder, Susie McDonald, Mary Louise Smith. And I'm always missing one, Jasmine. Who is it?
Claudette Colvin.
That was all of them? Okay, so I got all of them.
And then the one you play.
I
said her first.
Yeah. But we also wanted to expand to think about the people who were making really big waves in the movement at the time. So Joanne Robinson joins the cast, as well as we do have some male roles that are played by female characters, lawyer Fred Gray, a police officer, things like that kind of round out the cast.
And Deborah.
Oh, Jeanetta Reese is who I was forgetting.
There it is, Jeanetta Reese, giving our respect to her. Deborah, you also have a familial tie. What inspired you to write this story?
Yeah, my mom told me that I had a cousin that sat on the bus before Rosa, very flippantly one holiday. And I was like, what? You can't just drop that and not give me any other information. But I started to dig in and found Aurelia Browder, who has my mother's surname and grew up about an hour from where my mother grew up in Alabama, and started doing ties. I'm not exactly sure where it all kind of fills in together, but there definitely is a really, really strong tie in thinking about how that heritage is an extension of kind of the women who I know in my family and the ways that they move.
That's amazing to kind of find out like the ways that we're each connected, or that, you know, to find your own family connection. Jasmine Habersham, you portray Claudette Colvin, as we mentioned. What was it like preparing for this role?
Oh my gosh. You know, preparing for any role, I like to do a lot of research, and this, I have to say, was kind of hard because there wasn't much research about her in general, which is, again, why we're doing this opera in the first place. But in terms of developing the character and trying to figure out who she is, again, there's such a wonderful libretto, as well as I had some books to read. I also went to the Civil Rights Museum in Birmingham and got to, kind of delve into, you know, what the mood and the feeling and what all these women went through. It was really fascinating to do that because I happened to be on a gig while I was in Birmingham, and I was like,
that's
okay, exactly. So I was
get
like,
a little work done.
Exactly. So I went to the 16th Baptist Church, and even though those things, you know, they were at different points of the timeline, it was amazing to see from the beginning of the bus boycott in Montgomery and how it led to those major other events that happened. So I took a lot of my information from there in terms of developing the character, but it's been a pleasure to delve into it.
Jasmine Barnes, so you and Deborah, of course, you began working on this show a while ago, back in 2022, but of course it is always relevant because, as we know, last month President Donald Trump signed an executive order called Restoring Equality of Opportunity and Meritocracy. It seeks to cut back on the disparate impact liability, which is a core principle of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Did you anticipate that She Who Dared would be so relevant today?
Oh, not at all. I mean, unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. And so there's always a space of relevance for history, especially Black history in this country, which is often erased, often forgotten, often left out of the fuller picture of America's history. But we didn't know how relevant it would be. But like, it, now it just feels like, yes, it had to happen now. It had to happen in 2025. And there is a bit of fear in the classical community around putting these kinds of works out into the public, not for their own personal reputation, but more so just fear of the government right now. And I think that is the stance for a lot of organizations and institutions. And it feels good to be like the resistance in presenting this opera.
Right, because and the arts have been on the chopping block under this administration as well, we know. Yes. And we don't often see Black history-focused operas, Deborah. Right. Why did you think opera is the right medium for this story?
Well, I know Jasmine started off as a opera singer, and I came in kind of with a little bit of a classical music background, but really thinking about this space as one that a friend of mine says is ripe for revolution, right? Where we've seen many Black singers from, you know, Jesse Norman to Marian Anderson, right, come through these spaces and really start to break down and change how things are done. But that's not necessarily always culturally how we talk about this space. And so I think it kind of just felt like the perfect fit to think about how music, and especially Americana music, really plays a space in being able to provide spaces for classical music and Black stories.
And Jasmine Barnes, you're also working with Decomposed, which is Chicago's Black Chamber Music Collective. Tell us about why they're the right fit for this story also.
Oh my goodness, the first orchestral read-in last week, walking in and seeing the room look exactly like yourself. And it's beyond that, the same thing for the cast, walking in and seeing the room look like you. It's something that's not fully experienced all the time in classical music, and we're often one or two people in the room. To have the whole room be that is exciting. And they're not just there because they're Black. You know, they're there because they're amazingly talented. That's from the cast to the instrumentalists. They're, I mean, literally top in the country. And I think in the world, okay? And I think that's, you know, I think that's also something that's really special to Chicago, too. Chicago has a wealth of classical musicians. And I'm not sure if everyone knows that, but like, Chicago is that place, okay?
Right.
And we're really happy to present this work here because we get to work with artists like that are in Decomposed. And they even expanded the orchestra for this production because normally they perform as a quartet or a quintet. And this time they are performing with everything we need, percussion, wind instruments,
a full orchestra,
you know, yeah,
to meet the needs of the opera. We've actually had the executive director of Decomposed on the show along with Jamila Woods several weeks ago, so happy to give them another shout out.
Oh, yeah.
Jasmine Haversham, you are a Macon, Georgia native, so
yes.
How does it feel to be able to portray, you know, such an important history of the American South as a Southerner yourself?
Yeah.
It's not something you often do, probably.
You know, something I think is really amazing about Claudette's character is her strength and resilience to be smart and bold as a character. And I often think people have this really wrong connotation about people in the South, that we're uneducated, we're, you know, lazy, all these things. And I feel like this opera breaks down a lot of those barriers in terms of understanding each one of these women had something to fight for, no matter their station or education. I'm very proud to, you know, live in the South, and I want people to understand the beauty of how grounding it is to be there, and also talk about the issues that there's some really deep incredibly racist and deep roots that are still haunting us today. But I feel proud to represent it.
Yeah. As a fellow Southerner, I'm excited to share this story and excited to hear about it. So that's what we'll have to leave it. My thanks to Jasmine Ariel Barnes, Deborah Deep Mouton, and Jasmine Haversham. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She Who Dared premieres June 3rd at the Chicago Opera Theater. We're back to wrap things up right after this. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.